Welcome to the Lemper Report Live. On today's broadcast, SNAP benefits are ending and what that means for supermarkets. Is Sprouts Markets the best partner a brand can have these days? 2023 might just be the year of dining alone. Congress comes to farmers' aid, and on food crimes, we celebrate National Margarita Day. Or do we? On the bullseye, Coca-Cola goes out on a limb, and I think it's about to break. Check out Food News Today on supermarketguru.com for the most up-to-the-minute news feed courtesy of our partnership with Zizen. But first, out of the ridiculous pile, an Oscar Mayer Wienermobile was parked at a Sonesta Suites hotel in Las Vegas to help celebrate Super Bowl. Thursday before the game weekend even started, thieves sawed off its catalytic converter. Seriously, folks, stealing from the Wienermobile? That just ain't right. According to the Las Vegas Metro Police, over 2,600 catalytic converter thefts were reported in 2022 in Las Vegas alone. Nationwide, the thefts are over 10,500. Let's get started. So, Sally, on this emergency SNAP benefits, it's expiring because the pandemic is over, even though, in my opinion, it's not quite over yet. So here's the basis. Basically, you've got to make $17,424 a year or less to get SNAP benefits. For one person, it equates to $234 a month. Two people, $430 a month. But now what's going to happen, because these benefits, because of the pandemic, are expiring, a lot of people are going to go hungry. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so Phil, this extended program to the SNAP program started during COVID to help people. And now 32 states are preparing to phase out this emergency food stamp plan. I believe 18 states have already done this, but this is going to leave about 30 million Americans that are on food stamps right now. At the end of the month, they're going to be affected dramatically like this. The average that individuals are going to lose is about $82 a month in benefits. And this, coupled with what we're seeing at the supermarkets as far as pricing, particularly on much needed products, staple products like eggs and dairy, this is really going to affect a lot of people in a negative way, I believe.
It is. And when we talk about SNAP, you know, I mean, a lot of people think of, you know, people that are young and for whatever reason they might be out of work. But also there's a lot of people, a lot of senior citizens who are on SNAP that are trying to make it through their Social Security, through SNAP, through Medicare, Medicaid, and so on. And this is really going to take a big bite out of that. In fact, what we find is recipients that are now getting $281 a month, that's going to go back to $23. That's, you know, what they were getting before the pandemic. You go from $281 to $23, millions of Americans are going to have some severe problems. And the question is, for supermarkets that now, and it depends on the supermarket where they're located, they've got 20 to 30% of their volume coming from SNAP recipients. What happens to the supermarket once you start taking away that money? And we've seen, you know, sales obviously during the pandemic increase in most supermarkets. You're going to see a trickle effect of not only are these people going to get hungry, they're not going to be able to buy food, but the supermarkets are going to lose a huge influx of capital as a result of it. So it's something that, you know, I wish, and nobody asked our opinion, but I wish that they would have phased it out gradually versus just the end of March, because I think it's going to hurt a lot of people. Talking about helping people, there's a report in Modern Retail that I found fascinating, why food startups are flocking to Sprouts Farmers Market for their first major retail launches. It talks about a lot of the brands that are there, But and also it's important to note, you know, now Sprouts has, I think it's 381 stores throughout the country. So it has become a major retailer, if you would. What they did is they talked to a lot of these startups, and they said that Sprouts buyers work quickly are enthusiastic about innovative and better for you products. And then the CEO, Jack Sinclair, great guy, met him, liked him, is saying that what he wants to do, and he has put in innovation centers in stores, is to generate buzz and to underscore to shoppers that there's always something new to get excited about. So here's a retailer that is really curating products, making it exciting for customers, and also helping up a lot of these smaller companies.
Yes, I love the innovation centers idea, you know, where they have a rotating array of products that are new. According to Sprouts, they have talked about how their customers are into natural and specialty foods. And so they're a little more willing to try new brands. They're looking for new things, and they're willing to pay a little more money for these products. So this is a great opportunity for these new products. Some of them are finding it easier to get into Sprouts and get more brand awareness than in Whole Foods, Whole Foods has been known for doing this for these type of products. So I'm really excited about this program that they're doing, and I hope that it brings some new products to the forefront and gives them an opportunity to grow within other retail stores.
Absolutely. And really, every retailer, you know, should be doing this. Now, I know that there's a lot of retailers, HEB, Hy-Vee, and so on, that have these events where local brands can come and pitch to get on their shelves. I think that's fabulous. And the more of these retailers that do this, it just helps everybody. To your point, it helps the consumer, helps Sprouts, you know, have something that's different, helps the brand. You know, it's great versus just that mentality of piling it high and selling it cheap and taking whatever anybody brings you. And then, you know, if it doesn't sell, they throw it out. So Sprouts buyers and merchandisers are really getting behind these products and helping them succeed. And I think that's a major role for retailers, especially these days, and especially as they've got to compete with online, where if you go on Amazon or any of these sites, you're just seeing product after product after product. There's no emotion to it. Sometimes the information's correct. Sometimes the information isn't correct. Let's bring back some passion, if you would, to supermarkets. Talking about passion, there is a food writer and cookbook author by the name of Angelo Comste that he has issued his 2023 trends. One of his trends has nothing to do with the foods that he's talking about. It's about solo dining. He says that eating alone is no longer a taboo as more people are finding joy in solo dining. So I guess, you know, you don't want to deal with other people. Just leave me alone, give me food. He also said it's become totally fashionable thanks to the pandemic. And you can check out thousands of TikTok videos with the hashtag solo date and dining alone. What do you think? Is this going to be a trend? Are we going to see these hashtags, you know, grow and do something interesting?
Yeah, I think this is really interesting. You know, and Angelo Comste talks about how this trend could be attributed to the popularity of a South Korean trend called Hanbap, which comes from two words, Hanja meaning alone and bap meaning food. And so this became a popular trending concept and hashtag in South Korea. And maybe that's where it started. He also talks about the pandemic that you mentioned, and now people being more willing to eat alone. On TikTok, there are 9.6 million hashtags of dining alone and 201.5 million of solo date. So clearly it is catching on in some way. And I'd love to see how restaurants respond in creating this dining experience for them. Like, is there a smaller, more intimate table? Or are we looking back at that trend that we saw a few years ago, you know, before the pandemic, where we saw big community tables where the people that were eating alone could come and join other people at a table? I'll be curious to see how that plays out.
Yeah, I agree with you, because based on what he's saying, it's that, you know, I want that small table by myself away from people so I don't have to relate. And then when we look at the community table, that whole premise is, you know, I don't know anybody, I don't have friends, I don't have a date. So if I sit at this community table, maybe I'll meet somebody that, you know, is worthwhile talking to. So I agree with you. It'll be interesting to watch to see if it actually happens. You know, just by observation, I have noticed more people eating alone than probably I have in a long time. And again, I would point to the pandemic as a result of that. But we'll see. Or are we just getting more antisocial and we don't want to deal with people?
I think it's all moms, Phil. Moms wanting to eat alone.
Okay. Yeah. Or we could do
just a theory.
Okay. We could do that. You know, Politico, who I have great, you know, admiration for, interviewed four members of Congress who are working farmers, and they asked them certain questions. So the first question that they asked is, what's driving up costs for your farm? So obviously, Senator John Tester, probably the only working farmer in the Senate. John Rose from Tennessee, he was the former Tennessee Ag Commissioner. He has beef cows on his farm. Then we've got Jim Costa from California, an almond farmer who represents Fresno, a critical agriculture district in California's Central Valley. And I am, Doug LaMafia, a rice farmer in Northern California. So what's interesting is what most of them said was the price of fuel, the price of fuel and the availability of parts and cost for tractors. They talked about that. They talked about the cost of fertilizer in it. I love the fact that they're talking right to farmers. But, you know, Costa added one thing that I found really interesting, that we've got a problem in this country, he said, we've not been able to address successfully, and that's the amount of food waste, whether it's in our schools or other products. One of the things I want to look at in this farm bill reauthorization is how we can do a better job with the impact of food waste, something that we talk a lot about to consumers that, you know, they're saying, oh, the price of food is through the roof. Well, look in your cupboard, look at your habits, because the 40% of all of our foods is wasted in this country. And a lot of that has to do with how we deal at home. So it's a problem. But now John Tester just put in another bill in the Senate that relates to farming. What's that about?
So this bill is more about our farmland and who is buying our farmland. And what he's interested in doing is not allowing our U.S. adversaries, that would be China, Iran, North Korea, and Russia, would not allow them to buy up our farmland. Now, this is controversial, you know, with some, because critics of it say, well, you know, if they're off, basically, if they're offering a bigger price, then people should have the right to sell their land for that price if they want. And then John Tester's response to that is that he, you know, he still wants you to have the right to sell your personal property, however you want, just not to these four countries, because they actually propose a national security threat.
And to that, you know, the Air Force recently said that a proposed Chinese grain facility was close to its base near Grand Forks, North Dakota, and that presented a national security concern. You know, I happen to like Tester a lot. He's going to be running for re-election next year. I hope, you know, he gets reelected. I think from an ag standpoint, he gets it. He understands it. He's no BS. I really like him a lot. And to be honest with you, I never really thought. I know that China, for example, you know, bought up Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, and they bought a lot of real estate, office buildings and so on, both in New York and in other cities. I never really thought about the farmland until I read about this bill. And I think he's on to something. And frankly, you know, again, maybe controversial, love to know what our viewers think, but I think he's dead on. I mean, you know, it's not only buying up the farmland and whether it's a national security risk, but even just growing our foods, you know, let's take care of the U.S. farmers first. And as it is, we import a lot of food from China. We import, you know, all of our manure for our cows and chickens and so on from Russia. Maybe it's time that we really looked, you know, who's running, you know, agriculture here and step up. And good for Tester. And you have my vote. Not that I can vote in the Senate, but if I could, he would have my vote. You know, February is it's Black History Month. Mm-hmm. But you found some Black-owned restaurants during Black History Month and how we can access them. Tell us a bit about that.
Yes, it's so easy. And you know, Phil, I took my daughter to the mall this weekend to go shopping, and I was really excited about a couple of the stores we went to and bought something. They were taking donations for certain Black organizations. One was for a mental health organization, and one was for to help Black girls with opportunities. And I also love that so many people are using the roundup method now, instead of saying, do you want to donate $1? Do you want to donate $2? The rounding up method seems like, you know, it would compel people more. They don't feel like it's hurting their wallet so much. So I just wanted to say that first, that is fantastic. But also, if this month or any time of the year, if you want to go and support Black-owned businesses, you can go on Uber Eats, DoorDash, Caviar, whichever platform you use. Probably you can search on Yelp, you can search on Google, you can just look for Black-owned restaurants, and you can look locally what is in your area and support them. And I think this is just a wonderful thing that I did not even know was happening on these sites. So hopefully they're promoting it better than, you know, because I haven't heard a lot about it. But yes, it's a great opportunity to support our Black-owned businesses.
And also, you know, we always talk about ethnic cuisine. And we look, you know, outside the U.S. borders, what's going to be hot, you know, Pakistani foods this week, Thai foods the next week, and so on. And it would be great to be able to look at some of the cultural foods right here in the U.S. That exist and be able to try them. And those delivery services, as you described, make it really easy and really simple for us. Also, there are a couple apps, Eat Okra, both for the iPhone and the Android. You can get that. That'll have it. There's the National Black Guide that has over 1,300 food, dining, and health and fitness organization. Oh, sorry, just under food and dining, 1,300. And eatblackowned.com. Featured over 4,000 Black-owned eateries around the world. So another way to celebrate Black History Month without getting political and just getting like some good food for a change. So thanks, Sally. This Wednesday is National Margarita Day, so let's celebrate. But heads up, retailer and shoppers better beware. A bit of history first. The earliest occurrence of the famed cocktail was in 1938 by the father of the drink, Carlos Danny Herrera. He made it in his restaurant located in Baja California for a famous customer named Marjorie King. She was a dancer on the hit American theatrical Broadway Ziegfeld Follies, and she was allergic to spirits, but not tequila. The margarita he created was triple sec, tequila, and lime juice. 10 years later, in 1948, Margarita Sames of Dallas High Society said she created the drink in her vacation home for her guests in Acapulco, Mexico, in 1948. Tommy Hilton of the Hilton Hotel fame, who was friends with Margarita, attended the party and then brought it back to his hotel chains and put it on the menu. Jose Cuervo, the tequila brand, claimed they invented it, and it was running ad campaigns for the drink in 1945 with the catchphrase, "Margarita, it's more than a girl's name." Today, there are a lot of variations. Some people add Cointreau or Grand Marnier. Some people prefer Blanco or Reposado tequila, but basically the recipe is always the same. Tequila, an orange liqueur, and lime juice. That is, until now. This brand, Big Sips, sent me their version of a margarita, and I'm really confused. It's not that simple. The larger package makes three 3.7-ounce drinks. That has 15% alcohol by volume, and the ingredients are malt beverage with natural flavors and certified color. The package front says Margarita Fresh Lime, retails for $3.99, and there's no fresh lime in it. The 200-milliliter single-serve size is marked as Classic Lime. This one has 16% alcohol by volume, and its ingredients are agave wine, which is actually made from fermented blue agave and then fortified by blending with a Blanco tequila. Also, natural flavors and certified colors, retails for $2.99. So the question is, why not straight tequila that has a much higher alcohol content? And what's with the malt beverage? Remember what happens to wine coolers when they change from wine to malt? What about the triple sec, the fresh lime juice? This is no margarita, and it's misleading to consumers and a food crime in my book. Retail buyers, take a look at the ingredients before you put it on your shelves.
So how does it taste, Phil?
Well, Sally, as you know, I'm a margarita drinker. I like tequila. And neither of these taste like a margarita. Neither of them taste like tequila. It's it reminds me when I was in camp many years ago, and they had a concoction, a drink, and we used to call it bug juice. and we called it bug juice because all the flies and stuff would always be around, you know, the open pitchers of it. And I think that the bugs liked it better than we did. Don't try it. Don't try it. On today's Bullseye, Coca-Cola has announced that it will raise prices once again in 2023. The reason? Well, according to the CEO, they have earned the right to price with the consumers through enhanced marketing and an agile packaging approach that balances premium and small entry-level pack sizes for broader consumer appeal, according to the company. What does that even mean? CEO James Quincey, on an investor call just last week, was discussing the company's fourth quarter earnings, explaining that even though the inflationary environment appears to be cooling, Coke is expected to see elevated inflation across its operating costs. He went on to say that it's not our strategy to think of our businesses as commoditized, where prices flow up and down in kind of a mechanical way. We need to do our own pricing by delivering for the consumers value that they appreciate through the marketing, innovation, revenue growth, management, the pricing, packaging work, etc. He explained on the call that Coca-Cola has earned the right, in part through increased marketing spend and creative campaigns that link occasions and passion points to drive engagement. I don't know about you, but I'm really not that passionate about any soft drink, certainly not one that keeps on increasing their price. So let me get that right. Rather than offering shoppers the same or discounted pricing, they're taking the money to spend in advertising. In Coke's fourth quarter, organic revenue grew 15%. They're forecasting revenue growth of 708% in 2023, primarily led by the price increases and mix of products. Ah, Unit sales, however, declined 1%. Reference point. Quincy owns over 32,000 units of Coke stock, and that's worth over $20 million. He made, last year, as chairman of the board and CEO of Coca-Cola, according to Walmine, $18,701,100 salary. Now I understand who has that passion to raise prices. The Lemper Report is all about inspiring ideas, making our industry think, and challenging each other. Let's think about being the shopper and how we can bring our supermarkets and restaurants closer to meet shoppers' needs. I hope you'll come back to join us on next week's installment of the Lemper Report Live, when we'll focus on the biggest and best insights and the things that really matter to our industry. Be sure to visit supermarketguru.com for the latest marketing analysis, issues, and trends. And I hope you won't forget to join us back here next Monday at 2:30 p.m. Eastern for more. And by the way, happy President's Day.